Hey everyone, this is Hashtag History. I'm Rachel, and can you believe we have made it to the end of yet another season? Unfortunately, there was a scheduling conflict, and my co-host Leah was unable to join me for this season finale episode, but I know that I speak on behalf of the both of us when we say that season 14 was like none other. It was our return from our longest ever hiatus due to a lot of really horrible and also really exciting life changes, and we just needed time to regroup and figure things out. But we've been so happy to be back at it and have been so encouraged by all of the support that you all have shown us since our return. We are so honored to be a part of this history podcasting community and are so excited for the many things to come. As for this week's episode, we are joined by a very special guest that you all already know and love. So tune in now to hear my interview with New York Times best-selling author Amber Hunt as she discusses her new book, Crimes of the Centuries, The Cases That Changed Us. And be sure to stick around until the very end of the episode to get the scoop on what the next few months of the podcast is going to look like. Thanks.
I'm Rachel.
And I'm Leah.
And this is Hashtag History,
the podcast for both history nerds and history haters alike,
where we dive into history's greatest stories of controversy, conspiracy, and corruption. We are so thrilled to have you back on the podcast. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. So for those that have been with the Hashtag History podcast for a while, you know that we had the pleasure of having Amber on as our season 9 finale guest, in which you discussed the Osage murders. I haven't shared this with you yet, but that is actually one of our most popular episodes to date.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
I know. So either our audience super loves you, or they were coming because of the Leonardo DiCaprio movie, or a combination of the two. Either way, I know that our listeners are going to be super thrilled to be hearing from you once again on the podcast.
Well, thank you.
Amber is a New York Times bestselling author and the host of the hit podcast Accused and Crimes of the Centuries. And this week, we're going to be talking to you all about your newest book. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
I have your book here, and just looking at it, I know all the blood, sweat, and tears that must have gone into it.
I foolishly thought that it wouldn't be that huge a lift because most of these cases, when I wrote the book, I had research for Crimes of the Centuries podcast episodes, but I re-researched them. I found new details and that, for starters, was just labor intensive and fascinating. Sure. But then you really do write quite a bit differently for book versus podcast. So the whole thing is redone.
Yeah. It sounds like a giant undertaking. And I have to say, since I'm looking at the book right here in front of me, it is a gorgeous book. It's one of like the most beautiful books I've ever seen. It's so well done visually with all of the graphics and the quotes along the margins. It's really amazing.
Thank you.
So let me ask you then, you kind of already alluded to this. How long did it take you to write this book from start to finish?
Again, I thought it was going to be fast. It really wasn't.
We always
do. It was about a year. I pitched it, and I mean, first off, I am a fast writer, generally speaking. It's sort of required of me in journalism, right?
Sure.
We have these deadlines and you're sent, you cover something and you have to write a story within an hour. And so usually once I've done the research for something, I'm a pretty quick writer.
Mm-hmm.
But to get everything right, I had to go through such nitty gritty and dig up old court cases and re-research the stuff, especially because, as I'm sure you know, when we research these cases, we dig into it at that point, and then a lot of the details go out of our brains.
100%.
To make room for other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to go back in every case and like find the old newspaper articles that I had cited earlier. If I'd realized I was going to write a book, I would have saved that stuff along the way. But yeah, so it ended up taking a good year. And the design, I actually am really proud of how we worked out. I didn't design it, but the publisher, which is Union Square, they had a vision for it to make it very visually appealing.
It is.
Which at first I was a little nervous about, that could be sensationalistic.
Sure.
And it's not. It's no. It's a very classy looking book, which is nice. I don't like going that route. It's hard enough to balance telling these stories in a respectful way and in a way that you want to interest people so that they'll want to consume them, because you don't want the cases forgotten, while also, you know, not trying to present it as straight up entertainment, because that's definitely distasteful. So
it's the constant complicated complex.
Exactly. Of doing, you know, this. That better than most.
I feel like our podcast, both of our podcasts and your book now, have very similar themes. You know, we've talked about this half a dozen times before, that our podcast, we cover a lot of historical true crime adjacent topics, like the ones that you've covered, such as the Tylenol murders, the Radium Girls, Salem Witch Trials, Kitty Genovese. We've covered all those as well. I could go on and on of all the ones that we've both covered. But what I was hoping to do this week is to pull into those small little parts in the back of your mind for all the details about kind of these lesser known cases, or at least lesser known to me. There are a handful in your book that you talk about that we have not yet covered on our podcast, though they could very well be on our ever-growing future topics to cover list. I'd have to dig through there to see.
I always find it interesting, right, to hear somebody else's take on a case. There's no one perspective. As soon as I'm interested in a case, I end up going down a million rabbit holes trying to consume everything. So.
I'm so glad you said that, because so your book, I would say like 50% of the cases I'm really familiar with, and the other 50% I'm not. And the 50% that I'm familiar with are the ones I devoured first. Like, I'm like, why is that? Just like human nature, that when you know something about a case already, you want to consume as much content about it as possible.
Yeah. And I think if it interested you once, and hopefully there's some, you know, takes in there, some information that was new to you. That's always the goal, right?
Yep.
I mean, if I felt like I couldn't bring anything new to a case, I wouldn't. And in fact, that is the premise of Crimes of the Centuries. The name doesn't necessarily convey this, but the premise behind the podcast was that I wanted to look at cases that were all over the front pages, but that you don't know today. So we specifically don't do Ted Bundy. Mm. And I'm going to have to break that to a listener who just sent me a suggestion for Ted Bundy.
Interesting. Never heard of him.
Yeah. The trailer, you know, I make a point to say no Manson, you know, no Amanda Knox. No, none of the ones that have had multiple docuseries about them, especially in recent years.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm glad that the lesser known ones caught your interest too.
So what I would like to do then, to segue perfectly, is to talk about some of those lesser known cases, because I'm sure there are some in our audience that are not familiar with them. And even myself, as we have already discussed both on air and off air, once you consume something, the details fly away out of your mind. So I've already forgotten some of what I've read. So I was hoping the first case that we could talk about was that of Pearl Bryan. So I'm hoping you can just tell us all the things.
Yeah, Pearl Bryan's an interesting case. She was from Indianapolis. She was, you know, in her 20s. She's a pretty young woman. The year is 1896. And she was in a relationship with Scott Jackson, who was a little bit older. She was 23. He was 28.
Mm.
He was known to be a ladies' man. He was said to be very striking. He was, you know, a handsome sort. He ended up moving to Cincinnati to go to a dental school that was here at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And their relationship continued. Sounds weird to me to say somebody fell pregnant. It's a very active thing to become pregnant, but she realized she was pregnant and she sent him some communications over, you know, the
Pony Express
telegram system that they had at the time. Yeah. And basically it was like, you know, there's a situation and we should talk about it. And she traveled to Cincinnati, and it seems, obviously it's tough to track precisely what somebody's intentions were back in 1896, but it seems that she traveled to Cincinnati in the hopes that he would marry her.
Sure, of course.
And when she arrived, there were reports of her and him being spotted around. And it's fascinating to read about locations. I live in Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. So he came to Cincinnati, and they're down at these areas that I know very well. And ever since reporting on the story, when I walk around there, I'm like, oh, this, you know, you see it differently when you realize that it was a scene of some pretty dramatic exchanges in this woman's life back in the day.
Can I interject real quickly just to ask, was that part of the draw to this particular case? Was that it was local to you?
It was. In fact, This case was on a front page that I was looking at when researching something else.
That's how it happens.
And it was this one that made me think about like all of these cases that were huge news. And then I'm a reporter in this town. I had never heard anything about it. Granted, I'm a transplant, but that's not my fault. I'm a military brat. I grew up nowhere and everywhere. But this was the case where I was like, you know, I just kept getting sucked in. So then I went to the next day's newspaper and the next day's newspaper. And that's when I realized that I really was interested in just digging into these things that, you know, nobody knew about. Now, it turns out that a lot of these cases do have some background material on them beyond the newspaper reporting of the time, which is super helpful. But it's usually local stuff. If if it's a case like this one, you know, there's, as far as I know, never been a Pearl Bryan, you know, docuseries or movie or what have you. But there was a local historian who wrote a book about it. And so I got to interview him for the podcast. Oh, cool. That sort of thing. My interest in the case wasn't just that it was high profile and on the front pages, but also that they used a new investigative technique at the time, a new to them investigative. It sounds very pedestrian to us today, but they found a beheaded body in Fort Thomas, Kentucky, and it was a woman's body. They didn't know who she was, and she had very small feet. And her shoes were still on. And by removing those shoes and doing a little digging around the label that indicated where they had been made, it sent them to a shoemaker in Indianapolis. And the unique size of the shoe, it was a size 3, allowed the maker to say, oh, well, I only sold, you know, a few pair of these. And here are the buyers.
Wow.
And that's how they narrowed down that it was Pearl Bryan's body was based on these shoes. And this was revolutionary at the time.
Yeah.
So what had happened was that Pearl had come hoping to get married, and instead she was murdered.
Oh.
There is talk, and it's not really clear exactly how that happened. There had been some theories that maybe he, being Scott Jackson, her boyfriend, had attempted an abortion. Medical reports don't back that up, though. So it seems more that he just wanted to get rid of this situation, and he recruited a roommate to help him, Alonzo Walling, and they never fully copped to the story. But what we know is that witnesses saw them around town. You know, sometimes Pearl was crying. There were witnesses who spotted Jackson putting what looked to be medication or a solution in a drink that she was consuming. And so
he was really not sly.
No. It was a really heartbreaking case.
Yeah.
He had a valise or a little handbag, you know, probably bowling ball size bag for the time, that had something heavy in it. And he had handed the night that Pearl Bryan was last seen alive, he had handed it to a barkeep, had him keep it there overnight. It was a little heavy. And then the next day he came and picked it up. And the next time that the valise was seen, it was empty, but there was blood and some traces of blonde hair in it. Yeah. So the theory was that maybe he had taken her head to his dental college. There was an incinerator there because the head was never discovered. The body was very much discovered quite quickly, in fact, on this chunk of land. And clearly the hope had been of the killers that she would be impossible to identify. She was from another area. You know, her paper trail largely suggested that she was going to see friends in another town altogether. So I think they thought they were pretty much in the clear. There were so many witnesses who had seen the two roommates together with this strikingly pretty woman that there was no chance getting away with it.
Yeah. And unfortunately for them, she has very tiny feet.
Yeah. Yeah. Such a strange, it really humanizes for me when, you know, these details. Scott Jackson and Alonzo Walling ended up hanged for murder.
So why did this case become so sensationalized? Why is this one of those crimes of the centuries?
It was actually really interesting at the time that there was so much sympathy for Pearl, because her situation normally would have been, you know, really looked down upon. She was impregnated outside of marriage, gasp, But the general consensus was that she had been a well-liked, you know, well-revered person in her hometown. And it seemed that she was trying to do what society thought was the appropriate thing, which is marry her lover. Mm-hmm. And she died for it. So there was a lot of sympathy surrounding her. And then just the gruesomeness of it, yep. I think, really captured people. You know, the notion that a young girl, a young pregnant girl, travels to meet the person she thinks she loves and ends up beheaded and just discarded like trash.
Awful.
I think really resonated with people.
Mm-hmm. That case is awful, but really fascinating to see the way that, you know, this new, like you said, it's kind of pedestrian to us now, but this neat new investigative tool that was used to help track down who this unfortunate victim was is pretty neat.
I know. And so one of the things I did with the book to make it different from the podcast as well is I tried to group the cases under like themes.
Yeah.
This one was forensic advancers. Yeah, because it really is interesting when you group them under an umbrella. Mm-hmm. And even though this is a small snippet of each, I mean, I could have done a whole book just on the, you know, various cases that pushed forensics and just made the 25 cases focusing on that. But when you pluck them out from different eras, you can really see the jumps, the strides mm-hmm. we made. It's fascinating to me.
I appreciate actually that you mentioned how you broke it up, because I was going to bring that up to our listeners in particular, because of the majority of our listeners obviously being history nerds, is that part two of the book is all about societal shifters. And these are monumental historic cases that truly changed the course of history. So things like the Satanic Panic or the Bath Massacre, or there's the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fires. And so I'm glad that you brought that up, because I think it's so fascinating how you broke the book apart.
Thank you.
Into parts like that, because each one of these parts really are history changers. They are catalysts for change that we can see now from these crimes of the centuries.
Well, thank you.
The other case that I was hoping to talk with you about is of Stanford White. This one I do know a little bit more about. And speaking of gruesome cases, I know this one is particularly gruesome.
Yeah. Part of the interest in this one is similar in that it was centered around a young, attractive woman, although she was really historical in her own right. She was Evelyn Nesbit was the original It Girl, they say. So it's hard to imagine now, because when she started, it wasn't necessarily photography, although she did have a lot of photographs taken, but it would be her likeness drawn on a set of playing cards or what have you. Her face was everywhere.
Wow.
And then it did shift over into photography. She just had this like angelic look about her that there was a boldness to it as well. So when she would look at the camera, you would see other photos from the time and they'd be looking aside. And there were a number of photos of her where she's like staring into the camera, and it's very direct and unique for the era.
I love that.
So she was this beautiful young wannabe showgirl. Mm-hmm. Like she was hoping to act and sing and stuff. But she was incredibly successful as a model. And she ended up in a relationship with Stanford White, who was a renowned architect at the time. He was in the newspapers on a regular basis for the buildings that he erected. And this is at the turn of the century, 1906. Yeah. So it's in the early 1900s that she has this relationship with Stanford White. It's a terrible relationship. It's called today rape. I mean, it's straight up rape. It ends up morphing into something that you can argue is consensual, but she's very young. He's, I think, in his late 40s at the time they start seeing each other. She's a teenager. And their first sexual encounter, she was provided alcohol by him. She lost consciousness. She woke up naked and no longer a virgin.
Wow.
It's odd, because when I interviewed people for the podcast episode, they were hesitant to use the word rape.
Oh.
Because the times were different and yada, yada. But no, it was freaking rape.
It was rape.
Especially at the time, because one of the power plays there is that then he gets to say, oh, well, you're ruined. No one will have you now.
Right.
So it's very much ruinous for a young woman in that era.
There are certain things such as rape that don't need to be contextualized, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's back in the day, people might not have recognized it as such, but that's what it was.
Mm-hmm.
So once Evelyn gets past the criminal start of this relationship, she becomes more amenable to their encounters, still a questionable relationship because she doesn't have the power in this situation. Stanford White is famous. He's older. He's rich. But they continue on. And there was a movie based on the case called The Girl in the Red Velvet Swing, because part of their relationship like centered on him taking her to these side apartments where he had things like a red velvet swing, and she would swing in them naked. And it was very scandalous at the time. Now, nobody knew any of this stuff except Evelyn's husband in later years, who was a man named Harry K. Thaw. So Harry Thaw was another rich guy. Like Stanford, he was somebody who had seen Evelyn on stage and become smitten with her. And she gave him a shot. He was also not healthy. I mean, this poor girl, she was very much controlled and manipulated by these older men. But Thaw married her despite a very dramatic conversation they had pre-marriage, during which she told him that she had been deflowered by this other man. And Thaw beat the crap out of her. She couldn't get out of bed for days after.
Oh my God.
And then he sort of did what I guess we would call nowadays, it's called like retroactive jealousy or something like that. He just fixated on this past relationship she had had. And by this point it was over. She probably had aged out for White is what happened. Right. But, you know, she still had feelings for him and all this, but was happy to move on with Thaw. So strangely, though, one night, Thaw and Evelyn went to an outdoor theater performance. Mm-hmm. It was like on a rooftop performance. So they're outside, they're watching this comedy play, and Stanford White shows up, and Harry Thaw, in front of the entire audience, walks over, pulls out a gun, and shoots White dead right there.
Were they expecting him there?
No, I don't believe so. It's a little bit... we don't totally know for sure because he was known to go there. So did Thaw have it in his head that something might happen? Possibly. But he did arrive late. So there was a decent chance that this night could have unfolded in a completely different way if things hadn't aligned just as they did. Mm-hmm. So Thaw ended up pleading not guilty by reason of insanity, which was very unique at the time. And he got off.
Wow.
It was a bizarre case. A lot of these cases that resonated so much, there usually had to be a woman involved. It so happens in this one, the woman wasn't also the victim, but it was a really monumental case. From this, there was a lot of emphasis put on this supposed unspoken law or unwritten law that if your woman was violated, even prior to you knowing the woman, that you were justified as a man in attacking.
Oh my God.
Yeah, no, it was cited. There was never any legal citation pointing to it.
Was it clear that the woman had to be violated, not that she had just been deflowered? I don't know if I'm phrasing that correctly. The distinction between she's no longer a virgin of her own consent and accord versus having been violated.
No, in fact, the fact that it was what we know is rape now really was a side issue. And in fairness, like, Thaw is not the first case where this comes up. There's another case in the book that I look at. Daniel Sickles was a hero and a politician, and he shot and killed the son of Star Spangled Banner writer Francis Scott Key. He didn't write the Star Spangled Banner, but he did write the lyrics for it. And he was obviously very well known in America. And his son, Barton, was a womanizer to the extreme. He had been in a faithful, as far as we know, marriage, but she had died, and this was heartbreaking for him. He fell in love with Daniel Sickles' wife, and Sickles found out about it. This is entirely consensual, but Sickles walked across Washington Square with a pistol in his hand and killed Barton in front of a group of people, and also was found not guilty because he was upholding family values.
And Daniel Sickles, you talk about in your book as well. You actually have them chapter to chapter, Sickles and Stanford White. So now I see why you did that.
Exactly. One feeds into the other. And you would think that because the Sickles case, 1859, the Stanford White murder is 1906.
Right.
You would think that these decades in between would have made some kind of difference in how, you know, people viewed women.
Yeah. No, I'm sure in all of your research, you know that, and likewise as someone that studies history, is that change takes forever.
It really does.
Nearly 50 years is not nearly enough to actually take account of women.
I absolutely did not appreciate how short a human lifespan was when I was younger. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't interested in history much mm-hmm. either. It really wasn't until I started to look at it through these cases, in part because it's a way to look at it through a very human perspective, mm-hmm. right? As opposed to blah, blah, happened on whatever date, you know, I can yeah. relate to the people involved. And even like, I understand world history much better now through these cases mm-hmm. because of all the different variables that play into it. It's been really eye-opening to do this.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that I'm reaching other people who aren't inherently history buffs, because I wasn't initially either.
We're probably not doing ourselves any favors by having the word history in our title to reach right? non-history lovers. But that is one of the huge goals with our podcast too, is to tell these stories in a way that is engaging and entertaining enough that you get those so-called history haters to kind of change their minds. And I think you're definitely doing that with your podcast and with this book. You've done a really wonderful job.
Well, thank you. I agree that yours is doing the same.
Oh, thank you. Finally, the last case I'm hoping you'll tell us more about is that of Theora Hicks. The chapter covering this case is titled The Coerced But True Confession. So this is super intriguing, and I want you to give us all the details.
Yeah, this one's fun. And I'll say, too, that I got to do something really neat for the book that I didn't do for the podcast episode on this. And that is, I got to hold the trial transcripts. They were typed up.
That gave me goosebumps.
It was really neat. Mm-hmm. I know it was. In fact, I took some photos of it. I was all excited that I got to do that. So, and there are only a handful of the copies left anywhere. And one of them happens to be at the University of Cincinnati. So like Pearl Bryan, this is another case somewhat local to me. Theora Hicks was a student in Athens. She was a student at Ohio State University, which is where her eventual lover, James Snook, was a professor. Now, James Snook had been in the newspapers before because he had been on the USA Olympic team for pistol shooting. It's not exactly what I usually think about when I think about Olympic athletes, but so it goes. He was married. He had a child. Still, he ended up in a relationship with Theora Hicks, who was very progressive for the time. So their relationship lasted 3 or 4 years. It started in the mid-1920s, and it began sort of innocently enough with, you know, Theora, she went by Teddy. Teddy needing a ride in the rain and Snook offering it to her. And she was very much for women's lib and very...
It is the 20s.
Yes, exactly. Very much a woman of the 1920s. So they began having a sexual relationship. And it sounds like, you know, things were maybe a little more serious on Teddy's side than on Snook's. And she might have gotten to a point where maybe, you know, she was saying she would tell his wife or something like that. They were breaking up. Mm-hmm. They went out in Snook's car for perhaps a final dalliance. And according to Snook, he was attacked. Like, he said that she got upset. She lashed out and started fighting him, biting him in sensitive areas. And he pushed her out of the car and he ended up shooting her. And so she died out in the middle of a field. Snook was a professor of veterinary medicine, and he invented a method to spay animals that is still used today. He created a hook. It's called a Snook hook, and it's still used in those procedures today, which I just find interesting. So now when Teddy turned up, it was impossible at first for police and her friends to really grasp what would have caused this, because she was a free spirit who really didn't seem to have any enemies, didn't seem to get, you know, and tiffs with anyone. And as far as her, like even her roommates knew. So as flirtatious as she was, as forward as she was, she didn't talk about boyfriends. Her roommates at most suspected that she maybe had a guy just because she'd been out a little bit later than usual, but she never talked about it. So they really had no idea who might possibly be connected to this. But finally, some stuff started leaking out about, you know, maybe some car rides. And so police began to suspect that Dr. Snook might be their killer. They arrested him at his house while he was eating breakfast with his wife. And he was like, do you think I can finish breakfast first? And they're like, sure, we'll just tell your wife why we're waiting here. And he was like, okay, I'll go now.
That's a great exchange.
And then, you know, they beat the shit out of him.
Wow.
As they were interrogating him. I mean, we make jokes about like rubber hoses and stuff. Those jokes came from somewhere. You know, there were times in history where people really did believe that the only way to get the truth out of someone was through violence. We know now that that's actually far more likely to elicit false confessions than it is to get the truth. But that's why I think this case is interesting to me, because I do a lot of reporting on wrongful or questionable convictions, and a number of them involve false confessions. This case, he confessed after being severely beaten. I mean, red face. His conviction today would be thrown out. But at the time, it was seen as great police work. It also, to me, is this interesting mental exercise, because when I try to understand how police in some of the cases I investigate, how they can think that this approach was okay. Well, part of it is because historically, they would get these cases that felt like they were bolstering their approach, right? What ended up happening in the Snook case was that once he spilled his story, they went back and they tried to corroborate, and they corroborated all kinds of stuff. He and Teddy had been renting a love nest, and so people had seen them together going into this apartment. Once the police started digging, they found the landlady. They, you know, it was really easy to piece together what had happened, because every bit of what he said was true, and he ended up executed for the crime. And he was so notorious by the time he died that his wife buried him in a grave that didn't even include his name because it was so tarnished.
Wow.
And this had been a, you know, an Olympic gold medalist at one point and a revered veterinarian doctor and so forth. So it was quite a fall from grace.
Is that why this one has found its way into one of the crimes of the centuries? Is because of his notoriety?
Yeah, I thought this one was interesting, partly because this is one of those that really dominated newspapers at the time. And then who's heard of it, you know?
No, yeah.
And yet he still has this, you know, little device named after him. He made a historic mark, and then he represented the U.S. at the Olympics. That's no tiny feat. We have more recent examples of Olympians getting in trouble legally. but this was, as far as I know, the first of its kind. So yeah, I thought all of those things together made it worthy of exploration. And I really like, you know, I mean, why doesn't Teddy deserve the same kind of attention that, you know, Pearl Bryan has gotten?
Certainly.
It's not been that one's even less known than Pearl Bryan is. At least there have been some local history books written on her, but Teddy's case, the Snook Hicks case, really has fallen by the wayside.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you brought it to light, both in your book and for coming on our podcast to share about all these cases. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Congratulations again on this book. It's really beautiful. It's really amazing. I know it was so much hard work. I can't encourage our listeners enough to go check it out. Where can our listeners find you, your book, your podcast, and keep up with any future projects that you might be working on?
Well, thank you. Okay, so the book is at all the bookstores, and if you don't find it there, ask them to get it. You know, it's a wide release. Crimes of the Centuries is beginning this season. Season 4 is actually my podcast,
yeah,
which is very nice.
Yeah, I saw that. Congratulations.
Thank you. And but you can get early ad-free episodes at patreon.com/grabbagcollab, which is this like little side network that I've created with a couple of very talented friends. And we have multiple shows on this network now that are only available on that feed. Then also Kotze is available there too. I'm pretty proud of that. And on the social media stuff, usually you can find me at reporteramber.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much again, Amber. I know you are a very busy lady, so I appreciate your time.
I appreciate it.
Thank you all so much for listening to this episode of Hashtag History. Please be sure to check us out on Instagram at #history_podcast and to check us out on our website at #history-pod.com. You can also subscribe to us on whatever podcast platform you use, share about us with your family and friends, and also please give us a rate and review. You can also come join us over on Patreon, where for as little as $1 a month, you can help support our books and booze supply. You also get access to some behind-the-scenes content, an automatic 15% off all merchandise, and we mail you cards and stickers. And now for the update on the podcast. As you all know, our very own Leah is due with her sweet baby girl next month. Where does the time go? We want to be sure to give Leah all the time that she needs to settle into this major life change and to be able to embrace the newborn stage fully. So we will be taking a short break from our regular episodes and we'll provide you with a podcast update at the end of summer. But don't you worry, you won't be going months without hearing from us. In the meantime, I will be dropping Hasty History episodes. If you are unfamiliar with our Hasty History episodes, these are bonus episodes that we like to call Crash Course Cram Session History Lessons. So there are no ads, no bloopers. We don't even play our cheesy but adorable theme song. These are just some heavy history content that we squeeze into 15 minutes or less. We will be bringing these episodes to you in just a few weeks, so stay tuned for that. Thanks.